Good evening.
Good evening.
I just wanted to offer a suggestion about sitting. It's very, very good to harness the breath when we're sitting. That is to say, invite it out of the kind of automatic realm where it mostly happens. So one way to support that is to fill the lungs when you inhale, but gently. So not, you know, let the whole chest expand, let the diaphragm expand. Just very gently breathing in, filling the lungs, letting the breath travel all the way down to the bottom of the abdomen. It's kind of a, it's not exactly a visualization, but sort of. After all, the breath stays in the lungs, but breath is more than just air, as I think probably you all know. Let the breath go all the way down, and then when you exhale, as Sugiyoshi suggests, he says, put a little strength here in your hara, just a little bit, so like a little strong feeling, very, very gently, as you exhale. And then when the exhale is finished, just let that go. And once again, draw in a full breath, gently. And just something to try. In my temple, I often notice if someone's sitting next to me, I often find myself listening to their breathing. And it's pretty common that to me it sounds rather shallow. So, and I try to remind people, huh? Oh, you can't hear? Yes. Well, I could pick this thing up. No?
Try it again.
As I was saying.
That's better.
Oh, that's better. Okay. As I said, I often notice the breathing of someone who's sitting next to me, and it's often kind of shallow and kind of rapid. So then I usually suggest, you know, try this way of filling the lungs and emptying the lungs in a sort of tidal fashion, and it actually also supports awareness. When our breathing is kind of shallow and we're not really paying much attention to it, it invites the mind to wander and kind of be kind of dull. So to engage the breathing this way can be very helpful. We should also bear in mind, as Sugiyoshi says, the point of our practice is not to have some special state of mind. If you do cultivate a sitting practice, you will encounter special states of mind. And some of them are interesting, some of them not so much. But we should be clear that even if we encounter what feels like, this is a great state of mind, I really like this one, to then start cultivating that particular state of mind isn't really our practice as we've received it. To approach practice in that way means that we are just selectively generating attachment for certain states of mind. And inevitably, that means the flip side is going to come up too. Namely, you'll find a state of mind you don't like, and then you'll spend time trying to get rid of it. So to practice neither attachment nor aversion to whatever is arising in the body-mind is one way of talking about this practice. And another way to say that is that this is just allowing our spirit to flourish. I suppose maybe some people who talked about practice have spoken of sitting as like blowing on flames. Get the flames up, but I'm not sure that's quite right. Our actual spirit is already flourishing. And it's true we don't usually pay much attention to that, and we don't And you see, it doesn't have any special taste, this flourishing, because it's our natural state. So you don't feel some kind of, you know, special high or something. This, of course, raises the tricky question of, are we practicing in order to be happy? It's like, not exactly. You see that, again, also in discussions of Dharma study, that this is the way to happiness. And yet, it's difficult for me to see where exactly that hooks into Buddha's teaching as I have encountered it. Buddha does not promise happiness. Right? Buddha promises, or says, follow this path and you will defeat dukkha. And of course, dukkha is not exactly the antithesis of happiness. There's another Sanskrit word that sometimes people translate as happiness, and that's sukha, which is kind of the flip side of dukkha. It doesn't exactly mean happiness. It means something more like ease. Ease and flexibility of the body-mind are definitely factors that will manifest in practice. But again, it's usually not a good idea to pursue that. If we're pursuing anything, just like anything else, if you're out in your yard chasing your dog, eventually you're gonna run out of energy long before the dog does. So the suggestion is, in our practice, don't be chasing anything, and don't be running from anything. Right? Sitting in this way that has been passed on to us is a way of allowing the spirit to flourish without interfering. Even though, you can't really interfere, but we can get very tangled up in our own agenda and our own idea of what practice is supposed to be like. And that's our human way. So it's very helpful when that sense that, now I know what my practice is supposed to feel like and I'm going to get that.
Mm-hmm.
When that manifests, it's good to notice and say, oh, look what I'm doing. I think I know how practice is supposed to feel all the time. And actually, it's supposed to feel the way it feels. So this sort of cultivation that is predicated on what Dogen calls the backward step is sometimes rather challenging, because it feels like where's our touchstone? You know, where's our where are the factors that we return to over and over again? And, what's the teaching that I'm supposed to hang on to? And all these human ways we have of trying to clutch at straws as we're all basically drowning. Which is sort of what human life is. As Sugiroshi put it, human life is like getting into a boat, sailing out into the ocean, and sinking. It's like, that's pretty much it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he got that one right on the head. So, so to be, to find some sukha, some ease, in the midst of being that kind of a sailor, it's great, and the way to encounter this kind of sukha is not to grasp after it, to find a way to support living such that the strong karmic tendency to dukkha is allowed to subside. And that takes a while. Our habit mind, habit body, habit energy is very strong. So the, you might say, antidote, although that's maybe a little bit too chemical sounding, the antidote is to strike a posture that is so totally in the face of karma that the tendency of karma to be constantly built upon over and over again is weakened over time. And if indeed you take up Dharma practice sincerely, that is what will happen. It's basically guaranteed. And if you think that's not happening, you're probably wrong. But if you are thinking that's not happening, talk to somebody. And ask your Dharma friends, what's their experience? And above all, remember, when we sit in such a way that the flourishing of the spirit is not interfered with. We were talking a little bit about the tankas and stuff on the walls here, and some people prefer a very kind of bare aesthetic, but some of the monasteries in Japan, for instance, that I've seen, have some quite spectacular artwork. Not so much in the Zendo, but even there occasionally, the altar has very, very, very beautiful statue of Manjushri, usually in the form of what's called the holy monk, the Shoso. So it's a little bald guy. But sometimes, usually, these statues are very, very beautiful, beautifully executed. But also, in some of the corridors, you'll find these magnificent, huge paintings of dragons, for instance. Some of the monastic paintings are considered national treasures. They're you know, from the 17th century or even older, and by a very famous artist. And the energy of the dragon is remarkable, and that is a depiction of the flourishing spirit. That's what the dragon is. That's what the dragon means. I've looked at these tankas that you have, that someone has put on the walls, and they too are depictions of the way the awakened mind expresses itself. And I don't actually remember what these all are, but I think at least one of them maybe is a wrathful deity, and whether the wrathful deity, remember, always has a peaceful reflex, and vice versa. The peaceful deities have a wrathful reflex. And as I think we've said before, which face is manifesting depends on whether this magnificent flourishing energy is being regarded from the point of view of attachment or non-attachment. If it's attachment, that energy expressed as that being can look quite scary. Lots of teeth and claws and severed heads and stuff. But that same deity, examined from the perspective of non-attachment, becomes pacific, becomes peaceful and welcoming. So that's the pivot there. I don't know of any Buddhist, I can't really think of any Buddhist tradition that is well represented in the modern world that is a good analog of the very, very severe Christian sects that regard any sort of decoration as the work of the devil. I don't know if that trend exists in Buddhism, at least not that I found. Religious artwork, paintings, and so forth, and sculptures are expressions of the spirit and meant to be encouraging, meant to represent the inexhaustible creativity of this human spirit. So, as the saying goes, sitting quietly doing nothing is how the spirit flourishes. And the more profound our trust in that becomes, the more our ordinary everyday life will be affected by it. the more our trust deepens and our ability to be present in the midst of even difficult circumstances becomes stronger and stronger and more deeply rooted. Or rather, its deep roots will be revealed. So it's worthwhile remembering that practice should not be just another of our projects. Right? That's actually not very helpful. And Buddha Dharma is designed to show us the realm beyond our projects and our points of view and our states of mind and so forth. And this is revealed in the midst of practice. One of the priests at Suzuki Roshi invited to come from Japan and help him, Katagiri Roshi. He's quite a character. I think some of you probably met him. I met him at Los Altos Zendo back when things were just getting started. And he seemed very severe, but he was actually very sweet. And he would occasionally say things like, he would be talking about practice, and he'd say something like, I don't think this is like Zazen you do every day. He meant to be encouraging. You know, it's like he was trying to present practice as already liberated, right? Not as some sort of checklist of tiresome chores, which is, you could present it that way if you want to. Namely, well, you have to do this exercise and then that exercise and then this other thing and so on and so forth. And that narrative of practice is sometimes helpful for folks, but my experience is sooner or later that gets set aside. And the kind of limitless, unconfined quality of practice comes to the fore. Again, better if not pursued. Just let it be. Right? Do not try to make the spirit flourish. Just let it flourish, because it is flourishing. That's called our human life. And so as I'm speaking, there's another little narrative going along underneath, and I keep hearing my inner voice say, nothing burns like injustice. And in my experience, I think that's right. Nothing burns like injustice. So I've encountered in my practice life there in San Francisco recently some pretty severe injustice, and man, it really burns. And if you're a hate type like I am, it's very easy to get very angry and worked up about it and start thinking, man, when I see that person, I'm going to paste him one. And it's like, oh, wait. This it's well known, I think maybe mostly in Tibetan circles, that if you want to see the contingent self, just get wrongly accused of something. Boy, there it is. And there it comes up. It's like, oh yeah, well, put up your dukes. This is the sense that is inspired when someone is unjust to us. So I guess I just want to say that I am practicing with that a lot right now, and that it can be done. It can be done. One can allow the spirit to flourish in the midst of injustice. What you do then, I'm not sure. some injustice, it's pretty clear, needs to be opposed, I would say. The notion that all we ever have to do is just keep giving in, man. It's like, no, I don't think so. Some things need to be opposed. It's sort of a maybe not very useful generalization, but I see stuff going on in the world and feel like, I think that needs to be opposed. And not just met with like, oh, whatever, you know, I'm a blissful Buddhist, it's all fine with me. It's like, yeah, no, can't do that. At least I can't. So then the question comes up, okay, if you're going to oppose injustice, which injustice, take your pick, there's certainly plenty of it around, are you going to oppose? What if it's aimed at you? What if the injustice, you're actually the target? Then what do you do? Well, I have to remind myself to not neglect my sitting practice, not neglect my practice with others in the Sangha, and as much as possible, whenever possible, remember Buddha's teaching. Which, by the way, y'all know the word mindfulness? Has anybody never heard that word? Okay, I figured. So this is a big deal nowadays, mindfulness. You know, it's everywhere. Some of our modern scholars have pointed out that actually it really looks as though one aspect of that, which is kind of, you don't hear so much about. Mostly you hear about mindfulness means you are present with whatever is emerging as your body mind. And that's true enough. But also, sati in Pali or smriti in Sanskrit seems to mean remembering Buddha's teaching. So in addition to being present for the phenomena of our life, it also means remember what Buddha taught. This is pretty important. And as I say, if you're a hate type, like I am, that can be very challenging because of the speed with which anger and opposition and aggression can just fly up, you know, really, really, really fast. And technically speaking, of course, what we experience psychologically as fast is already way slow, because supposedly the finest granularity of our inner experience is happening extremely fast, and what we think of as a moment contains thousands of so-called thought moments. So these phenomena, when they come up very fast. These waves move very fast, and sometimes they knock us down, or at least they knock me down. And mostly nowadays, I can be pretty careful. Even if I'm pretty pissed off, I can usually not do much damage. But the line is sometimes very fine. And so it's helpful for me not only to be present for what's going on, but also to remember what Buddha taught, either in a very general way or sometimes specific teachings. People love that quote from the Dhammapada about hatred does not cease by hatred. And I don't want to get on my hobby horse again. Yes, I do. Where people often translate the next line as by love. And it's like, no, that's not what it says. Doesn't say by love. It says by non-hate. Right? So I think we've talked about this before. Hate is ceased by ceasing to hate. Right? And there may be other teachings you could say. For instance, Buddha advises practicing metta or maitri, loving kindness. That's another practice. But in that particular utterance, he's saying, hate will stop when you stop hating. Right? The opposite of hate is non-hate, the absence of hate. So since it's so easy when these waves come up to just, you know, just get right in there and add to that energy over and over and over again, it's so easy to feed these unfortunate states of mind and body, that it's extremely useful to remember you can actually just stop. Right? Just stop. Right? When I'm sitting there thinking of all the terrible things I'm going to do to that person when I get my hands on him, it's like, oh, wait. Actually, I can stop doing that and watch the flashes of anger go by, which is just another dragon, by the way. Doesn't necessarily have to have a, you know, bad dragon sign on its neck. It's just another dragon. So, you know what? It's best not to feed the dragons that are running around looking for people to eat. Right? Those probably should not be fed. So I'm pretty sure all of us, if I talk about feeding states of mind, pretty much everyone with a little reflection will know what I mean. If it's very easy for me to start cataloging all of the terrible things that so-and-so said to me recently, and thus fanning the flames of that negative, aversive energy, aggressive energy. So when I see myself doing that, actually, as I said before, if you see yourself doing that, you're not doing it anymore. Yes, did you have a question?
It seems to me that there is a collective anger out there, and that it's really important for those of us who are anger types to be on our guard, because it can ignite us.
It can carry us away very fast.
It's so out there.
Yep. Yeah.
And my question then is, how can you oppose with non-attachment?
Well, if we have some sense of practice, some sense of Dharma study, even in the midst of a crowd, and people are like getting upset and angry, it's actually, again, possible to stop feeding that in oneself. And the people around you, if they're paying any kind of attention, which they may not be, will actually notice that there's someone there who's not being real excited. And even if I'm actually, you know, I'm feeling anger coming up, I don't have to fan those flames. And if I don't fan those flames, my body mind will be different from those folks who are fanning those flames for whatever reason. And these little islands of, whatever you want to call it, stability or awareness or mindfulness or something, have an effect on everyone who's around. Now, it may be overwhelmed because you're one person being mindful and there are 350,000 other people who are not. That's a rough kind of a, you know, you're going to have trouble with that. But even so, if you're that one person, Buddha will, well, actually, Buddha doesn't really bless people. But if he did, or she did, Buddha would express great gratitude to that person. It's that one person of the 350,000 who's actually noticing, oh, I'm kind of pissed off. How about I don't feed that and see what happens around me? Yes?
Well, when you say feed it or not feed it, is the feeding saying hateful words to yourself?
For instance, yes.
Yeah. And like, so then if you are practicing non-hate, you just try to interrupt that flow of hateful words
and
internally.
Yes. And the instant you notice the flow, you've interrupted it. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool, because anybody can do that, right? This is another aspect of this mindfulness or recollection. It's like, notice your mind, notice what you're doing. Now, for me, maybe it wasn't such a good idea, but I've actually kept all of the, really, I think, hundreds of nasty emails and text messages that I've received from a certain person. And it's sometimes very tempting to say, you know what, I think I'll just start reading these again. It's like, you know what, don't do that. No. I'm kind of keeping them for legal reasons. But it's like, I don't have to go back and read them again and get all pissed off. I actually don't have to do that. And if I find myself remembering a particularly juicy one, I can say, okay, you know what? Let's just let that go by. Return to what's happening right here. And yes, those things really hurt. And I get mad. So better to be present, you know, as the dragon is unfurling its wings, as the spirit is flourishing in whatever way it's flourishing, be present with that. Be there for that. Remember Buddha's teaching. And if there's hateful energy, notice that that hateful energy cannot continue if you don't feed it. It cannot. Right? States of mind are momentary. And we can keep that ball rolling, you know, like juggling, if you want to. But so much better, just, you know what, let those hatchets you're juggling, let them fall, let them drop. Right? And if in the next 3 seconds, oop, I've got a hatchet in my hand, again, guess what? Well, you can let it drop again. Did you have a question?
I think Clem had stuff before I was.
Clem, sir.
Yes. I remember hearing once, I think it was Elie Wiesel saying that the opposite of love is not hate, it is indifference.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that if you encounter hatred, indifference is a far more powerful way to deal with it because it diffuses it. Mm. It has nothing to feed upon.
Well, maybe a slightly more Buddhistical angle on that would be not so much indifference, but because I'm trying to think, what's the indifference? It seems like Buddha was more interested in equanimity, right? A kind of a state of body mind where you're neither leaning towards or away. You know, allowing that. If indeed, as Buddha teaches, there is a natural stability to the body-mind, to allow that to be present without going after something or getting away from something, you could say is a kind of indifference.
Are you saying that indifference implies a certain amount of non-awareness?
I'm actually just thinking of my own experience, which is, you know, just that, my own experience. But for me, when I think about indifference, it's a kind of deliberate chill or coldness. Like, I don't care about you. And that may not be what is meant when you're speaking of it. But in my experience, indifference is kind of a cold thing. And it seems like Buddha was more interested in, yes, cool, but not cold. Cool in the sense of balance and equanimity. And there are lots of incidents in the sutras where Buddha is talking to some pretty obnoxious people, and he's pointing out to them that their philosophical arguments are really kind of useless, and yet he's doing so in a way that is very calm and not accusatory or sarcastic or any of that stuff. And yet you get the sense that he has some care for the people he's speaking to, or he wouldn't even bother. You know, he'd just turn away if you weren't interested. It's like, okay, I'm indifferent to you people. It's like, I don't think Buddha was indifferent, but he was very, very calm. He had cultivated equanimity to the point where it was always present. So, you know, it's just something to think about, I guess.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of not really a single world pointed thing, but uh-huh. it seems like the left is, and I vote Democrat, but it seems like the left is like is really tied into certain types of righteous indignation. Mm. And I don't know, I was just watching this I Am Not Your Negro by James Baldwin, and
that's supposed to be great.
Yeah, I thought about three quarters of it was really great. Mm-hmm. And then about one quarter seemed to me that it was sort of like tapping into that same sort of editorializing piece, which seemed to me to be a devolution from the acme point which King and even James Baldwin had kind of achieved,
mm-hmm.
which was, and you could see it in these protests, and it was exactly at the time where you really didn't know whether, Jim Crow was going to be maintained or not. And it was, you know, it was about 50-50 whether what way it was going to go. And
yeah.
There was this great dignity on the part of these marchers, and it wasn't angry.
Mm, yeah, that's pretty impressive, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't have the pleasure of meeting Dr. King or Malcolm X or James Baldwin or any of those folks. I don't know if any of them were what Buddhism would consider hate types, but it doesn't seem like it. You know, mm-hmm. Hate type, such as I am, easy to anger, easy to aggression, you know, get all aggro on people. And therefore, that is what I practice with most vigorously. Now, one could also say that on the other side of the political spectrum, there's plenty of self-righteous indignation there, too.
Yeah, now, that's kind of like a given.
Oh, it's a given.
It's like, there's really nothing to observe there.
Yes, that's an interesting point. Well, so, again, self-righteous indignation, you know, for me, that's an easy thing. Easy to find that. I have no trouble finding self-righteous indignation. So, for me, noticing my involvement with that process interrupts the karmic flow. And so this is what I try to practice with. At the same time, recognizing that there may be situations where I decide, no, I'm going to oppose this. I am going to oppose it. I will try to do so with a quiet heart, but I am going to resist. And, you know, it may not turn out so well. But it'd be good if I could resist without being indignant and self-righteous. That'd be good. Because that actually doesn't seem to shed any more light or help anything.
Mm-hmm. Oscar, you sometimes characterize yourself as a hate type.
Yes.
I'm wondering. All right. I'm wondering if that's as in the popular trio, greed, hate, and delusion.
Yes. That's it. Yeah, you know, this is a very simplistic typology. Not as sophisticated as Jung's typology, for instance. But it's kind of interesting if you look at people as they are. It's possible to see, okay, some people, they seem to have a lot of greed in their life. Right? Some people have a lot of confusion in their life, are really confused about shit. And other people, boy, they got a lot of anger, you know, or a lot of aversion. And you can say, yeah, okay, so it's a very simplistic typology, but it has some applicability in practice. And so they say, for instance, okay, if you're a hate type, you should study perfect wisdom because you get to destroy the whole universe. It's like, oh, okay, cool. Or if you're a greed type, you should meditate on what's called the ashubha in Sanskrit, or the unwholesome. You know, rotting corpses, spoiled food, all this stuff. Okay. And if you're a confusion type, as we said, you should be an accountant. That's what they say. It's true.
I resemble that. I have a question,
yes,
with respect to the typology.
One brief thing, but Oscar, is that okay for now?
I'm interested because there seems to be some real avatars of greed, hate, and delusion in the environment. So so I think it's people who study it are maybe have a great study opportunity.
It's a great study opportunity. The first one, of course, is here. And then you can actually start to see, you know, wow, Buddha was not kidding when he said there are three poisons. Damn,
and
there they are.
And those poisons, as I understand, where they manifest are the same for everyone.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's like we share them.
Yes.
Like the oxygen.
That's our as sentient beings, that's part of our shared heritage. Fortunately, so is this great flourishing spirit. Clint, did you want to resemble more?
The way you're speaking of the types of personalities, so to speak, it sounds like one will tend to predominate over the other two. Is it possible for the dominant one to change?
Yes. Under the impact of practice, it is said that that's possible. Now, that tendency may remain, but Dharma practice tends to loosen those log jams, tends to loosen those habits.
What about under the impact of trauma?
That's an interesting thought. So, say a hate type is in a terrible accident, for instance, and then afterwards their dominant factor has changed. Is that what you're asking about, for instance?
That would be a loose analogy.
Uh-huh. Well, you want to make a tighter analogy? No. Trauma in the sense of physical, emotional trauma?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, obviously things change. The main teaching is that usually the poison that is dominant remains so, but its influence can be reduced greatly. And maybe it's just that I'm getting older, but I'm really not as crabby as I used to be when I was younger. I had ample energy to be crabby all the time. And that seems to be much less the case. And I would say that maybe some of that is getting old and decrepit, but also it's the effect of practice. So I'm quite encouraged in that sense. I'm also anxiously looking at there's a timer in here. So back when it was like 20 minutes, I was all anxious, like, well, I have to talk more. So maybe we could put a piece of tape over this. So I don't have to see how much more I have to say in order to be legitimate.
I don't think that time
it's
on there has anything to do
no,
with it.
No? Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes.
When you were talking about the wrathful image that might be in a tanka,
yeah,
and you said the reflex of that.
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand reflex in that context.
Maybe a bit more like reflection, like the mirror image of that.
Okay.
The mirror image of that when it is beheld from the point of view of non-attachment, it is no longer wrathful. Or you could say, okay, it's wrathful, but the wrath is not directed at me. The wrath is directed at attachment. The wrathful deities are not mad at us. They are angry at attachment. They want to defeat attachment.
It's interesting because I really have a distinct memory of seeing tanka images when I was young in college in Berkeley and thinking, what kind of a religion is this that would have this beast, this clawed beast,
drinking blood
yeah, out of
yeah.
a skull, and,
yeah,
you know,
man.
How would anybody call that a religion?
Mm-hmm.
And there's one of them here that has the claws surrounding the wheel of life.
Yes, right.
And to me now it's like look at this.
Yes.
Look at this.
Behold.
Look at this.
Right.
You know, it's a strong it's not quite a reflex or an inverse, but it's like I really have to impress this upon you.
Mm-hmm.
That this is how it is.
This is where you are here.
This is
you are here. Right.
And you could be you could be over here or over here.
You could be somewhere off the canvas completely.
Yeah, you could.
But yeah, you are here definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me it's like get serious about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good painting then that does that. Yes.
I like to look at those dragons and those wrathful creatures, not as wrathful.
Uh-huh.
Fierce.
Fierce? Okay, yeah.
Standing up to it, fierce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yes?
Yeah, I've kind of heard of some of those images as righteous anger.
Uh-huh.
Does that make
sense? Well,
he would agree with that, but...
Well, Suzuki Oji, for instance, as you probably know, says that sometimes anger is clarifying. He said, but it should be like a thunderstorm. Boom! And then finish. No holdover. Right? And in that sense, I think that's so. Yeah. Yes?
I just had a thought. It's a question. Does righteousness give rise to anger?
I think it can. Mm-hmm. So, if we are being righteous, what does that mean? my teacher, the dreaded Reverend Anderson, doesn't use that word much. He uses the word upright, meaning not leaning in some direction or other, rather than righteous. For that reason, because righteous does have this little bit of a tendency of, I'm so right and you're so wrong, you poor slob, which is like maybe not that helpful. Something. Yeah, turn.
I have an attitude towards anger that it's not bad.
Uh-huh.
What you do with it might be bad.
Yeah.
But anger itself is empowering and it's full of information
mm-hmm.
about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it troubles me sometimes to hear it.
Yeah. There is a bit of a almost puritanical streak in Buddhism. As you may know, some Buddhists are very, very fond of Shantideva and his text, the Bodhicaryavatara, the embodiment of the Bodhisattva path. And he goes on at some, to me, just me, rather tiresome length about how awful anger is. Awful, 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 awful. Bad, 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 bad. And I get his point, but I think he overdoes it. And then you wind up with a tendency to label emotions as bad or good in and of themselves. And that reduces possibilities. It does not multiply them. So to regard anger as what's just a phenomenon, you don't want to be carried away by it. You don't want to have to kill it. You just, as you say, if it's conveying information, let it convey information, and watch what you do with it. If your inspiration is to pick up the nearest blunt object and slug somebody, maybe not so good, not very skillful. Meaning, it's not going to help, right? To hit somebody over the head with a steam iron, right? These things occur to me sometimes. But I think, oh, no, probably not real helpful.
But it is very effective.
In the moment, you might say, it has quite an impact.
Short term.
Yeah.
Short term.
Question? Yeah.
It brings to mind that I may have misinterpreted a little bit of what I've read from Thich Nhat Hanh, that there are these seeds within us that you want to restrain from watering. And I think I interpreted that to mean, suppress. And what you've just said added a little enlightenment to me that they're there.
Yes.
They're going to come up.
Yeah.
Just try not to water them.
Well, exactly. The technical viewpoint is, and Buddha said this many times, that the mechanisms of karma will out. They will out. Karma will ripen. You cannot prevent that from happening. But you can cease from using that ripening as the occasion for generating yet more karma, which is another way of saying watering the seeds. Right? You can do that. That is possible. But you can't prevent karma vipaka from happening.
Or kill the seed.
Or, I'm not sure. What does that mean, kill the seed? Well, if you become enlightened, no further seeds will sprout. Okay, so that's good to know. Yeah. Okay, well, I don't know. It's 8:45. Is that maybe another one more question or two? No? You all good? Oh, yes?
A phrase that comes to mind by an individual named Tristan, acts have neither beginning nor end, which I find helpful.
That's vaguely like things Buddha said also. And in fact, trying to untie those knots and figure it out all the way back, no, don't bother. That won't work. Karen, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just thinking that, the vows obviously have something to do with being able to, not do the, or to do the non-hate.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The non-greed or the...
The karmic energy of these great vows carries us away from the tendency to keep heaping up karma, which is one aspect of their tremendous power. And personally, I think that's much clearer in the Mahayana than it is in the earlier stage of Buddhism, where there isn't that much emphasis on vow. And yet, as the Mahayana expanded, the recognition of the power of vows came more and more to the fore. Okay. Oh, we can recite the vows right now if we want. Thank you all so much for your patience.